It's time for Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervie. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan Gervie & Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. Joined today by his co-host, radio personality and television host, Kerry Kasem. Kerry brings a fresh, real perspective to the intersection of law and life, turning Murphy's Law upside down. And now, here are Alan Gervie and Kerry Kasem.
A good afternoon, Los Angeles, and welcome to Gervie's Law. I am Alan Gervie, and of course, I am the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan Gervie and Wynn. And today, as usual, as I am here every Saturday, I'm here to say that I'm the managing partner of your life. And we are so excited today because, as you know, for the last couple of weeks, we have been talking about the O.J. Simpson trial and the fact that it's been 20 years since the verdict in the O.J. Simpson trial. Actually, October 3rd, 1995, and last week we had with us Alan Dershowitz. Today, we are so thrilled and honored to have probably one of the greatest trial attorneys of the century, F. Lee Bailey. He is here with us on the telephone right here at Gervie's Law. F. Lee Bailey, welcome to Gervie's Law.
Good afternoon.
It is nice to talk to you, and I know you are in Maine, but I want to say something. I have to tell you, the first deposition that I ever did as an attorney in 1990, I was doing the deposition, and there was an older gentleman who was the other attorney, and halfway through the deposition, he went off the record, he was very angry with me, and he said, "Who do you think you are, F. Lee Bailey?" And from, can you believe, I remember, I went home that day saying, I couldn't have had a better compliment. Back in the day, when people talked about you like that, how did that make you feel when you were the master of the cross-examination?
Well, it's always good to be invited to address Bar Association seminars and other proceedings with distinguished lawyers, because I think teaching is one of the things that the trial bar in particular is much lacking. But just there are no places you can go to become a trial lawyer as you can in England.
And you have said that attorneys aren't what they used to be. What do you mean by that? You obviously have practiced in the golden age of the trial attorney, and things have changed. How have they changed?
Well, I'd like to quote Chief Justice Roberts, with whom I had the pleasure of having dinner a year ago, and I showed him this book, Excellence in Cross-Examination, which was just out. And he said, "You know, I'm sure that's a great book. I don't know who's going to buy it. Nobody goes to trial anymore." and he's right. The case is full. Left and right, the large firms in particular don't want to run the risk of getting hammered at a trial and losing clients. And so, with the exception of some small firms that have really good trial lawyers who aren't afraid of anything, it is a dying specialty.
Well, it is called The Excellence in Cross-Examination, and it is a book that F. Lee Bailey has written with Kenneth Fishman. And I'll tell you, they both go through some really interesting techniques. Isn't it true that cross-examination, and look at me, I'm saying isn't it true, I'm already cross-examining you, F. Lee Bailey, but isn't it true that it is an art and that there are real techniques that people can use rather than just thinking they can ask a witness questions?
Well, it's a mixture. There are principles and rules that work fairly well in cross-examination on a general scale, but there's a tremendous amount of individuality, and two great cross-examiners sometimes don't look much alike.
Well, that makes sense. Now, you have said that you think that you should keep your eyes on the witness, and through the years you learned so many nuances with body language that you could use in your follow-up questions. Is it essential that you look at the witness and you see what the person is thinking, or should you be walking around the room looking into the sky and asking your questions?
much more important to look exactly at the witness. If a witness is uncomfortable, you will see it first in their eyes, then perhaps later in their voice. But to know when to pounce, when the witness is vulnerable, you get it first from the eyes. And people go up to the podium with a bunch of notes and documents and things like that, I think are missing the chance.
In the excellence in cross-examination, you talk about the speed with which the questions are administered, that you don't have time to think out the maneuvers, that you need to take that cadence and make it work for that witness. How are you able to do that so easily, where so many lawyers start stammering and have all these problems with the cadence?
Well, I've been a public speaker since I was in my mid-teens in school, where I did debates and gave performances, and I majored in English. I have a good command of the language, and I trained myself a long time ago to maintain a prodigious memory. And those are all very valuable attributes if you want to machine gun a witness. And by that I mean, keep the bullets coming. Don't give the witness a chance to dream up or fabricate an answer. And over the long run, as to almost all witnesses, that works.
We are going to talk about your cross-examination of Mark Ehrman a little bit later and your comment that anyone would want to have cross-examined him. But again, when you talk about the keep those questions coming, you had an amazing ability, and you still do, but of course in your heyday some years ago, you had an ability to, like you say, you had a prodigious memory to bring out facts during the cross-examination that most people would not have been prepared. What is the role of preparation so that you only don't have to use your memory, but you actually have all the facts at your hands?
Well, the short answer to that is overkill. The day after I took the bar exam in 1960, I had the great privilege of having lunch with Edward Bennett Williams on the lawn of a mansion
Wow.
in New Hampshire, where I was educated. And I said, Ed, how is it that you seem to pull a rabbit out of a hat when you cross-examine witnesses? And he said, well, you've got to come to court with 50 hats and 50 rabbits and get very damn lucky.
I love that story. I'm going to do that. Next trial, I'm going to bring 50 hats. I'm going to remember that. You graduated first in your class in 1960 from Boston University Law School. Now, you had been at Harvard as an undergraduate. Then you went into the U.S. Marine Corps. What was it after the U.S. Marine Corps that really made you want to become an attorney and go to law school?
Well, while in the Marine Corps, I was appointed as the legal officer of the fighter squadron the day after the legal officer got killed. This was not a post that was filled by lawyers, but often was filled by people who had been to the six-week Naval Justice School in Newport, Rhode Island. And at first, I was not warm to the idea.
Right.
But after I'd been in court in a couple of cases, I thought, my Lord, this is the spot where I want to be. This is what I should do in my life. And was scheduled repeatedly to go to Naval Justice School and never could find an open 6 week where the commanding officer would let me go. When I got out of the Marine Corps, my appetite was thoroughly whetted. I had tried a lot of cases, acted as appellate authority in a lot of cases, and developed a bit of a street sense. And that's something you don't learn in law school.
So what kind of issues were you dealing with as a squadron legal officer? Because a lot of people wouldn't really understand, as a non-lawyer, how you would be able to deal with those issues in the Marine Corps.
Well, frankly, one of the most formidable trial lawyers that appeared in our courts was an enlisted man. He wasn't a lawyer at all, but lawyers receive so little training in law school that's even relevant to the skills required to try a lawsuit. But you don't have to be a lawyer to be pretty good at a lot of what we do. Now, obviously, at some point, you've got to know the rules of evidence, you need to know procedure, and things of that sort. But the best cross-examiners are still the gut fighters who would have been good gunslingers back in the dusty days of the Old West.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. Now, going back to your childhood, as you were interested in perhaps the law, obviously the Marine Corps, education, going to Harvard, how did your parents play an influence in your interests at that time?
My parents gave me a very wide road and let me pick my way along it. They didn't try to force me in one direction or another, but I developed early on an intense English, intense interest in English, not only writing, but speaking. And good English speakers are generally the leaders and the highest paid people in the world. So that was a good specialty to latch onto. It has certainly served well as a courtroom lawyer, even though I had no notion of becoming a lawyer until the Marine Corps decided that I could be volunteered for that post because the volunteer system is alphabetical and my name begins BA.
That's true. And when you talk about your speech pattern, your diction, your ability to communicate, one of the most riveting videos that anyone can ever watch is someone who is very familiar, or who was very familiar, with these type of speech patterns, William F. Buckley, when he interviewed you in a series of interviews, which can be found on YouTube now. What was going through your mind when you had William F. Buckley going toe-to-toe with you? And again, folks, if you have not seen these videos, you need to Google William F. Buckley and F. Lee Bailey's interviews.
First of all, when I went on his show, which was called Firing Line,
right,
I knew that this is one of the brightest guys around, that he had a tremendous command of the English language. But he was also vulnerable because he had an imperious attitude, sort of a better than now. So here we had Harvard against Yale,
yeah,
and he lit right into me with an almost insulting remark. He said, "I want you to meet a young man who makes a good deal of money through crime." And I shot right back at him. I know you meant that as a joke, Bill, but if you really wanted to appreciate this system and why defense lawyers are needed, you ought to get yourself indicted and go through a courtroom trial.
There you go.
It'll scare the pants off you and give you a new attitude. And after that, he never came at me again.
But you were inflammable in that interview, the coolest attorney that anyone could ever watch. And I'm sure many attorneys became attorneys because they saw how you handled his, what people might say was this arrogance, that he was trying to almost put you in a place where you were not going to go.
Well, I sat there thinking, I had seen Firing Line before. And although I didn't know Bill personally, I certainly knew something of his attitude and demeanor and his use of language. And I thought to myself, he doesn't realize it, although he did before the show was over, but we're in my backyard, not his backyard.
Right.
And this is what I do for a living. Frankly, once we settled down, it was a pleasant experience. But you can't let somebody get the first blow in the haymaker and then be wobbly for the rest of the fight.
That's true, and folks, again, you need to watch it. It is riveting to watch the two of them go at it, and there's so many interesting points that come out of it. We have to take a quick break. You're listening to Gervie's Law. I'm here with F. Lee Bailey, who is on the telephone from Maine. We will be right back.
Fraudulent material statement or material representation for the purposes of obtaining workers' compensation benefits is guilty of a felony.
Another day at work. The pain is getting worse, and I'm afraid to say anything because I need this job, and I don't want to get fired. If I wasn't the only one supporting the family, I'd quit.
Is this you? Are you suffering every day while your injuries get worse, and there seems to be nowhere to turn? Or do you have an injury that was brought on gradually by repetitive motion, and now you can't perform your job duties at all? For over 35 years, the law firm of Rowan, Gervey, and Wynn has represented those who have sustained an injury on the job or have become disabled as a result of work. They're the experts in workers' compensation. You need an advocate. You need someone who cares about the injured worker. You need the law firm of Rowan, Gervey, and Wynn to get you through the nightmare.
Friends, if you're suffering with a cumulative work injury, the law firm of Rowan, Gervey & Wynn is in business to help you. Find out more. Call the law firm of Rowan, Gervey & Wynn, 855-4-RGW-LAW. That's 855-4-RGW-LAW. Or go to rgwlawfirm.com. First consultations are free.
If you experience leg pain, swelling, discoloration, itching, or restless leg syndrome, you're not alone. At the Leg and Vein Institute, they believe everyone deserves to have beautiful, pain-free legs. Whether it's spider veins, varicose veins, or any disease of the lower extremity, the staff at the Leg and Vein Institute, led by Harvard-trained physician Dr. Siddiqui, have you covered. Don't settle for anything but the best. Visit the Harvard-trained physician at OCLegDoc.com now to schedule your free consultation. That's OCLegDoc.com.
What's the secret to financial independence? You need a steady passive income, something more than just wages from a job. At Compound Stock Earnings, we teach you how to earn 3 to 6% cash return per month from your investments. We're so confident in your success that we offer a money-back guarantee on our Fast Start seminar. Want to learn more? Tune in to Unconventional Wisdom, the CSE Investment Show, this Saturday at 8 a.m. right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC or visit CompoundStockEarnings.com.
Need some legal, moral, or just common sense advice from a friend? Call Alan Gervey and Carrie Kasem now at 800-222-KABC. That's 800-222-5222.
And we are back. You're listening to Gervey's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC. This is a special day for us at Gervey's Law. Last week we had Alan Dershowitz. Today we have F. Lee Bailey, who of course is the legend F. Lee Bailey, the most famous trial attorney in the second half of the century, as many people have said. He now lives in Yarmouth, Maine. He is still very active in the legal profession and with teaching those who want to be great lawyers, not just good lawyers. And we are talking to F. Lee Bailey, who everyone knows from the O.J. trial. You may know F. Lee Bailey from some of his celebrity cases. Of course, there was Sam Shepard, the Boston Strangler, Dr. Carl Capolino, Ernest Medina, Patty Hearst, Claude Dubac, and then O.J. Simpson. And we're going to talk a little bit about the O.J. Simpson case, as it is 20 years since the verdict was read. Lee, I got to ask you, one of the most famous pictures in the media on that day was O.J. Simpson standing in between you and Johnny Cochran after the verdict was read.
A blow-up of that on my wall.
I was just going to ask you, you have a blow-up of that on your wall. What kind of memories does that bring back when you look at your blow-up picture of the O.J. trial on your wall?
Well, for anyone who has one in front of them as they listen to this, and I must tell you, that picture was seen in more places around the world than any other photo in history, except for some in wartime. And the people are shown there, and I can tell you what was inside the head of each one, starting with me, then with O.J., then with Johnny Cochran, and at the end, Bob Shapiro, who
right.
is seen leaving the courtroom.
Walking the court away from the courtroom.
Well, he's on his way to do an interview with Barbara Walters where he trashed all of us.
You know, when I was talking to Alan Dershowitz, he said that Bob Shapiro may have made some comments that he regretted afterward because some people misconstrued him walking away because he was not happy about the verdict. What is your position on that one?
Well, it wasn't that misconstrued at all. Bob tried to take over the case from Johnny Cochran and worked out a plea for O.J., and everybody was incensed. O.J. had nothing to plead to. He hadn't done anything, but that was Bob's specialty. Trying cases certainly was not. So when the verdict came in, it's very plain in the photograph. He's unhappy, and if you look at the Barbara Walters interview, which was published that afternoon, his unhappiness is shown. And I will tell you a funny story. Bob was fired at one point before the trial,
right.
and he suggested that he might do something unpleasant with respect to O.J. even if it cost him his license. And O.J. had a very cool head. And he said, okay, Bob, we won't bench you. He'd asked Bob to become a coach. He said, you can still be the quarterback. But the rules are...
Just like Tom Brady, right?
Wing. Yes, we're using the single wing, not the T formation. Quarterback is blocking back. And number two, he said, no passing. And that set the tone for the game. And so Bob was really unhappy from then on during the trial.
So let's get back to your comment, because I do want to talk about the egos on the Dream Team, and you're suggesting perhaps there was some conflict there. But tell us about what was going through each person's head, because we got a little off topic when we were talking about Bob Shapiro walking out of the courtroom.
Yes. If you notice, I have a smile which resembles that of the Cheshire Cat. And that's because I knew what was in the envelopes. The evidence was overwhelming, and I assured everyone, including O.J., that there was nothing to worry about because the verdict was reached the day before it was published, and there was one night to get through. I went to comfort O.J., because I hadn't been present when the verdict was reached. I was lecturing down in, I think, Redondo Beach. But in any event...
Right.
He had a big smile on his face, and I said, well, I don't need to reassure you. You know what's in the envelope. How's that? He said, every court officer and every jailer has asked for my autograph and told me they won't have another chance. So that kind of tells me I'm going home tomorrow.
Yeah, you know, Lee, I got to tell you, when Alan Dershowitz was asked that question, he said that he didn't think that those people knew about the verdict or knew what was going to happen, but they were just covering their butts just in case O.J. was released. But you're saying that they actually knew that he was going to be found innocent.
I knew, and O.J. knew. I had assured Johnny Cochran, who had been in Napa Valley when the verdict came, that everything was going to be fine, but I didn't convince him. And if you look on his face, at the moment the verdict is read, you have a reaction that says, no kidding.
Right, right.
And Bailey was right. And I think that picture is priceless. It tells so much if you know the inside facts. I knew what was in the envelope for reasons totally different than O.J. Simpson, but I was very confident that it was nothing but good news. The circumstances just couldn't add up to anything other than a straight acquittal, and that's why the Cheshire Cat look. Now, Alan was told by Bob Shapiro that there was a conviction
right
in the envelope, and so he went on radio and said that he was cautiously pessimistic about the outcome. He, of course, was in Boston. I remonstrated with Alan, who's a very close friend, later on, and he said, well, I was misled. I should have called you instead.
Yeah, and that's what he said. And in fact, he was having his Sandy Koufax moment as he explained to us that he was observing Yom Kippur. He could have been there in the courtroom and been in the picture, but he did what he felt was right. He stayed in Boston and observed the Jewish holiday. And to this day, he says he doesn't really regret being in the picture, although he knows that there were a lot of emotions going on at the time.
Well, Alan was with us from the outset. He described himself as the God forbid lawyer who would be active in an appeal if we lost. But Alan is a brilliant man. He's been a friend of mine since he first started teaching at Harvard as a full professor at age 28. My brother was one of his first students. And I have enormous respect for him, and his advice is generally as brilliant as he is.
And as he does for you, as he shows in his comments, that he totally respected what you did in that case and how you were able to do some of the cross-examination work that no one else could have done. But the question remains, Lee, is it really true that after all that work on the Simpson trial, you didn't receive any money except perhaps $16,000 to cover your expenses?
I received the $16,000 before the trial began. I never saw another nickel because I found that Bob Shapiro had signed a contract obligating me to participate in the trial and saying that he would take care of whatever costs were involved. I learned about it by accident. He never gave me any money at all.
Did you ever approach OJ and say, hey, we did a pretty damn good job for you. Do you think maybe we should get paid?
No, OJ said that his ship would come in and he expected to get some money. But he had spent an enormous amount on the trial. In the early days, Bob was incurring huge bills, and it was just gone. So I never pressed OJ to that. OJ was and is a friend, although if he were to talk to me now, it probably would inhibit his parole if he really is in line for one.
Right.
And I figured I'll have to do it some other way. I'm not going to be able to squeeze money out of OJ, and frankly, I don't want to try.
Yet, you published a paper a few years back defending OJ's innocence, and you have said that if anyone reads that paper, they will understand that OJ did not do it. Is that true?
I went further, yes. I said that, and it's on my website, Bailey and Elliot. Anybody can read it. It's 17 single-spaced typewritten pages, and it was entitled. It was for a book publisher who wanted to hire me to write a book about OJ. And it says 10 reasons why the Simpson verdict was correct. Now, it turned out that the publisher discovered that if the book was published saying OJ was innocent, very few people would buy it,
right,
and therefore it did not go forward. But I will still publish that book before I cash in. I'm 82 and still have plenty of boxing left.
A young 82, that's for sure. Let me ask you, now, have you lost friends and professional acquaintances as a result of your connection to OJ?
Oh, I cannot tell you. I explained to my classmates at their invitation at a dinner why the verdict was correct and was just about hooted out of the room.
Wow.
And I had judges who said you corrupted your huge talents by taking that case and causing a better verdict. I had lawyers all over the place assure me that I did not create any new admirers by getting this guilty guy off. And that's one reason I published that paper, because those judges and those lawyers didn't know what they were talking about. They got their mouth in gear before they started their brain. And unfortunately, many in the legal profession, as you well know, have a habit of doing that.
It happens way too much where people don't look at the facts, they don't read the evidence, they don't read, for instance, your paper on this, but they still have a strong opinion that they refuse to change. Doesn't make sense, and sometimes I'm embarrassed to be a lawyer when I hear lawyers saying things without evidence and without facts, but being totally intransigent. Isn't that something that you have dealt with?
I have dealt with it, and in this case, I would have to say it gives proof to the maxim that ignorance is bliss.
That's true. Ignorance is bliss. And last comment before we go to a break, I want to know whether it is true that you actually said, after all the notoriety and the media attention of the OJ case, that it was an experience that you could have well done without.
It certainly was. It was a pain in the neck. I paid a heavy penalty because of it. I don't think I would have been prosecuted in Florida and later Massachusetts if it were not for the fact that people were outraged over Simpson's verdict and their view that I contributed heavily to it.
And we will talk about that a little later, about your being disbarred by Massachusetts and Florida, and your opinion as to why that occurred, whether you were railroaded or not. But we have to take a quick break. You're listening to Gervie's Law. We're talking to the F. Lee Bailey right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
If you like painting and saving, ask Sherwin-Williams and save 40% on paints and stains during our four-day super sale, September 18th through the 21st. With 40% off our exceptional paints and stains and 30% off painting supplies, you can give your whole home a color makeover. But hurry, these savings are so super, they won't be around for long. Find your nearest store at sherwinwilliams.com/sale. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Hey, John Phillips here. If you care about your financial future, then I want you to listen very closely. We've seen how volatile the markets can be in just the last few weeks. Are we set for another big correction like in 2008? Many institutions and brokers will keep you in the dark because they make their money on fees and commissions, often putting their own interests first. So I'm inviting you to call for two free passes to a workshop in L.A. or Irvine hosted by my friends at the Online Trading Academy, where you can learn how to start calling the shots and start making money when the markets go up, down, or sideways with a rules-based strategy. Trading on knowledge, not speculation, and identifying market moves before they happen. If you call 888-991-TRADE right now and mention KABC, they'll also send you home with a free $247 home video study course just for attending. This is a great opportunity to learn trading from the pros, but seats go quickly. Go to otaclass.com or call right now to reserve your seats. 888-991-TRADE. That's 888-991-TRADE.
At TIAA Craft, our record sounds like a broken record. We got impressive results in 2013. And 2014? Same thing. We're like, hey, weren't we just here? Then 2015, boom, more impressive results. That's the kind of record you'd expect from a company that's created to serve and built to perform. Intelligent investing, powerful results. Visit TIAA.org. TIAA Craft Individual and Institutional Services, LLC. Investing involves risk.
Every 40 seconds, 136 million emails are sent. Over 1.6 million Facebook posts are posted. And one person will die of heart disease or stroke. But you can make a difference.
Join 790 KABC and the American Heart Association at a heart walk near you. Help raise awareness and funds to build healthier lives in our community by forming a team with family, friends, or coworkers. The fight against heart disease and stroke starts with you. To form a team and find a heart walk near you, log on to kabc.com/events. Sponsored by Union Bank, USC Verdugo Hills Hospital, and Menchie's.
Welcome back to Gervie's Law, turning Murphy's Law upside down on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
And Gervie's Law is back. Yes, I'm Alan Gervie, and I'm here. And unfortunately, Carrie Kasem is not here. My usual co-host has the day off, so I'm flying solo, but I'm thinking of Carrie Kasem, hoping that she's having a great day. Nevertheless, we are doing our series on the 20th anniversary of the verdict of the O.J. Simpson case. And we are talking to the attorneys and the people who know the inside out of that case, and also learning a little bit about their life. Right now, we are so honored to continue speaking with F. Lee Bailey. F. Lee Bailey is probably the greatest trial attorney in this century, as so many people have said. There are so many cases that F. Lee Bailey has been involved with, dating way back to 1954 with the Sam Shepard case. Lee, tell us about your involvement in the Sam Shepard case and how that put you into the limelight.
When Sam Shepard went to trial in 1954, I was a brand new lieutenant. I'd just been appointed legal officer, and I listened to the news while flying around in an F-86. On the automatic direction finder, which could be tuned to broadcast frequencies. It was not until 1961, when I began to practice law and became well known for my expertise in the polygraph, something most lawyers stayed far away from, that the Shepard family came to me and said, we'd like to have Sam take a polygraph test, and we'd like to hire you, simply to make sure that it's fair. And so I agreed to do that, and I found out the state of Ohio was not going to permit a test under any circumstances, and the governor told me why. He said, Scripps Howard will break my back if I do this, because they take credit for convicting Sam Shepard, as well they should have.
Lee, I just have a question. How did you have such confidence in doing? You were a young attorney at that time. How did you have the confidence to pursue this?
Well, Alan, once you've landed an aircraft on a carrier, particularly a World War II fighter, you either have a lot of confidence or you don't make that second landing.
Yes.
And that's what I am most grateful to the United States, on the one hand, for my education and experience as a Marine and as a jet fighter pilot and a naval aviator. And I came into the law brimming with confidence. I gave my very first jury argument in a capital murder case where the defense lawyer had had a heart attack, and I was brought in and finished up the case. Thank God it was an acquittal. I'd probably been disbarred on the spot.
And, of course, you had a good result with Dr. Sam Shepard. Tell us about that.
Well, that was a long and torturous road. When I filed the petition under federal law asking that a writ of habeas corpus be issued to release him because of due process violations in his trial, the presiding judge, Mel Underwood, asked me, why can't I throw this out without reading it? And I shot right back at him because of three good reasons. They all begin with Charles. And he remonstrated with me for being flippant with the court. And I said, I'm not kidding. If you read last week's Supreme Court decisions, you'll find all three of them, and in each case, the plaintiff is named Charles. And he talked to his clerk, and he said, looks like someone's going to have to let this guy out and you know, sign this case to Carl Wineman over in Baden. And he did, and that's exactly what happened. Carl Wineman was a great judge. He had the courage of a lion, and he took the state of Ohio to task.
And he understood the facts and issues in that case. Now, afterward, there was a lot of fame and fortune with the television series The Fugitive and the movie of the same name in 1993. Is it your perspective that The Fugitive was actually based on the Dr. Sam Shepard case?
Well, since the producer of that show was also my producer when I had a TV show on ABC in 1967, I can tell you it certainly was the fact. And it turned out to be a tremendous asset. When I retried the Shepard case in October of 1966, after all the appeals were over and the Supreme Court had said he gets a new trial, the Fugitive had been running for a while. David Janssen was very popular. The show was very successful. And although nobody talked about it during jury selection, everybody knew the Fugitive was innocent. And that kind of lapped over onto Dr. Shepard, who probably for the first time in American history had a strong actual presumption of innocence going for him. And the younger people on the jury wasted no time in deciding that he should be acquitted, which he was. The movie came afterward, and although they both take some literary license, they're both about the Shepard case.
So was that the first time where you actually developed confidence in the jury system? Now, you have said that there are many disadvantages of a jury system, but you can't see any other system that would be better.
You know, it's like the Democratic government of America. It's got lots of problems, lots of shortcomings. It's laden with corruption and mistakes and other bad things, but there's no other system we've found that's any better. And that's true of the jury system. I still don't trust it. I see bad results come out of jury trials. Sometimes they stick. 13 people who were innocent were found on death row in Illinois. That doesn't speak well for the accuracy of the system. Still, it's the best we've got.
You know, the question becomes, because a lot of cases are so technical and the legal arguments are so technical, how do you expect the common person to actually understand your brilliance? I asked Alan Dershowitz this, and he said it is a flaw, but he still believed in the human condition, notwithstanding that a lot of the issues and the questions and the logic that someone like you presents a jury goes over their head.
Well, that is certainly true, but remember, there are 12 people on the jury, and if you can reach a couple of them and get them to comprehend what it is that you're saying, that's probably going to spread to others in the jury room and have a big influence on the verdict. And if things are not clarified during the trial, that's really the lawyer's fault. Jurors today are much better educated than they were years ago, and they're pretty thoughtful. So I give them a lot of credit for comprehending highly technical evidence and technical theories and rules.
Now, you have said that you don't get affected by losses in the courtroom. Let's talk, for example, of the Patty Hearst case and what your argument was. It was a very interesting argument. You talked about the Stockholm Syndrome, but it wasn't successful. Tell us about that case and how it impacted you.
Well, until Patty Hearst wrote a book detailing her experiences while she was a captive, I could not reveal the true facts of the Hearst case. I was hired to extricate her from a first-degree murder conviction, which was almost certain had she been prosecuted and had the evidence been marshaled against her, because, as she admitted, she was the getaway driver in a bank robbery in Sacramento, for which she was never tried. I got her immunity for that.
Right.
In which a pregnant woman was gunned down, and she and her fetus got hit in the belly with two loads of 12-gauge shotgun buckshot and died on the spot. To make it even juicier, when she got to the emergency room on a gurney for an official pronouncement that she was dead, The fellow who lifted the sheet to look at her turned out to be her husband, who was on duty that day. It was a terrible case, and she got out of that. But the trial itself was impossible. Patty Hearst could have been tried forever had we not been able to bring it to a resolution down in Los Angeles in the great Army-Navy store shootout for which she was tried there. It's the most miserable case I've ever handled, and yet I liked the Hearst family very much. I felt that Patty was indeed a victim and not a monster, and we did our very best to bring that home. We got saddled with one of the worst judicial rulings I've ever seen in my life, with nothing we could do about it, and it wasn't overturned on appeal. So that's just bad news. The good news is she got out in a relatively short time, whereas some people either get put on death row or spend their lives a great many years in jail for crimes which they should not have been convicted. I still think she did not deserve to be convicted.
And don't you also think that the defense that you put forward set the table for future cases when we look at motivation, we look at intent, we look at any type of mental incapacity to actually commit the act that someone is accused of?
Well, very frankly, coercion is rarely a defense. I've had to use it one time since then in a case in the military of desertion, and I was able to show to the satisfaction of the judge, there was no jury there, that the defendant had been brainwashed, that he suffered from the Stockholm Syndrome, and he was found not guilty by reason of insanity. But it's a rare bird, in Patty's case, there really was no choice. Any defense lawyer worth his salt, since the evidence showed very clearly that she was present when a lot of crimes were committed and participating in some of them, brainwashing was the only thing available. And it might have been successful had the judge not ruled that she was on the witness stand, and because he changed his mind, she had to take the Fifth Amendment in front of the jury as to the robbery I've described, where she drove the getaway car. That was a croaker and a carrier.
Croaker. Now, F. Lee Daly, we're running up against the break, but I do want to ask this question before we get to the break. You have been, it has been said that you said that you won't argue to a jury that your client is innocent unless you really believe it. How do you present your case if that's true and you don't believe that your client is innocent?
Oh, it's very simple. You argue that the jury should have a reasonable doubt because of the inferior nature of the evidence that the prosecution has presented. That's perfectly legitimate. What I meant was you don't put on false evidence like an alibi or concoct a self-defense argument, which is not true, and affirmatively shove it forward. A guilty person is entitled to one of two affirmative defenses. One is insanity, and the other is entrapment. And many people were driven away from my office because I laid out those rules to them, and they wanted a lawyer that would put them on the witness stand even for the purpose of lying.
Now, that doesn't include James Earl Ray, does it?
No. James Earl Ray tried to hire me, and he was in England at the time in custody. And I said to his solicitor when I had him on the phone, you tell Mr. Ray that Martin Luther King was a friend of mine. And if he, in fact, assassinated Dr. King, he doesn't want me as a lawyer. And if he didn't assassinate him, and he's not guilty, I'd be happy to defend him. And the solicitor said, I don't think we'll be needing your service.
And that probably worked out well for you. We're talking to F. Lee Daly. We have to take a quick break. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC. We'll be right back.
Any person who makes or causes to be made any knowingly false or fraudulent material statement or material representation for the purposes of obtaining workers' compensation benefits is guilty of a felony.
Another day at work. The pain is getting worse, and I'm afraid to say anything because I need this job, and I don't want to get fired. If I wasn't the only one supporting the family, I'd quit.
Is this you? Are you suffering every day while your injuries get worse, and there seems to be nowhere to turn? Or do you have an injury that was brought on gradually by repetitive motion, and now you can't perform your job duties at all? For over 35 years, the law firm of Rowan, Gervey, and Wynn has represented those who have sustained an injury on the job or have become disabled as a result of work. They're the experts in workers' compensation. You need an advocate. You need someone who cares about the injured worker. You need the law firm of Rowan, Gervey, and Wynn to get you through the nightmare. Friends, if you're suffering with a cumulative work injury, the law firm of Rowan, Gervey, and Wynn is in business to help you. Find out more. Call the law firm of Rowan, Gervey, and Wynn, 855-4-RGW-LAW. That's 855-4-RGW-LAW. Or go to rgwlawfirm.com. First consultations are free.
The glass is always half full when you're listening to Gervie's Law on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
And yes, we are back right here at Gervie's Law on Talk Radio 790 KABC and at KBC.com. It has been a privilege today to have with us one of the greatest attorneys of all time, F. Lee Daly. He is on the phone from Maine. Lee, tell us about your life now and what you've been doing since you've moved to Maine. It's Yarmouth, Maine. You love it out there. Tell us how that's going.
Oh, it's going wonderfully. I first came to Yarmouth, Maine, when I was a one-month-old infant in a basket.
Just a few years ago.
82 years ago. And I fell in love with the state, and I decided that when I quit running around and beating up on bad guys, I would settle here, and that's exactly what I've done. My day-to-day activities are still fairly frenetic. I do a lot of lecturing. I just got back from giving the keynote speech at the 50th anniversary of the formation of the American Pottergraph Association. This spring, I went to the Lake of the Ozarks to give a lecture to the Missouri Bar. I still enjoy doing that, And I also do a lot of consulting for lawyers, helping them make sure that the factual aspect of their case, not the legal side, but that the factual aspect is well prepared. In other words, the 50 hats and 50 rabbits bit.
Right, and that's something for all of us to remember. Now, of course, you were disbarred in Florida and Massachusetts, and you reapplied for admission to the main bar, and it was found on, I think it was a 5-4 decision, that you lacked the requisite good fitness and fitness necessary to return to practicing law. What was that all about?
Well, I obviously am a lightning rod. Maine is divided into two communities, north and south. The people from the north were not happy to see me take and pass the bar, which I did.
And how old were you when you passed that Maine bar?
Well, it was a couple of years ago.
Okay.
80
years old.
79.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
And yes. And so I had a hearing with the Board of Bar Examiners, 9 people. They voted 5-4 not to admit me. And they did so based on a mistake of fact, which they made. So I appealed, had a trial before a single justice of the Maine Supreme Court, as the rule provides. Don Alexander is one of the best judges I've ever encountered anywhere, and I say that not just because of the result in my case. After hearing all the facts, he found that I was fit and ordered that I be admitted. The bar appealed, and by a decision of 4-3, 4 of the justices said, well, Mr. Bailey appears to be repentant for his sins, but he's not repentant enough. And I couldn't argue that because I'm not repentant at all. I didn't do what I was accused of doing. So if you want me to admit it in order to join the club, you can go stop it.
So are you?
I write the book, and I will have my story at the end of the day.
And you're accepting the fact and continuing on as a consultant rather than a bar member in Maine, correct?
Yes, and you know, Alan, I think at the end of the day, I'm happier. I don't have to go to court when I'm ordered to. I don't have to cancel prepaid tickets for vacation.
Yeah, I have to do those things. We only have a minute left. One last question. I want to know what you feel about Nathan Lane playing you in the American Crime Story on the O.J. Simpson trial that's coming up.
I participated in a detailed interview for ESPN, which is doing a 5-hour special in December. And I don't know Nathan Lane or what playing me is going to involve. I do know that the fellow who played me in the Shepard murder case did a very good job. Walter McGinn, unfortunately, killed himself a month later driving a Porsche into his butt.
Okay, well, we're going to leave it on that note. F. Lee Bailey, we want to thank you for being on Gervie's Law. You've been an incredible guest. We hope we can have you back and hear more about some of your adventures another time. Thank you.
All right. Well, it's been a pleasure, Alan.
All right. Enjoy the rest of your day, Lee, and we'll talk to you another time. Thanks for listening to Gervie's Law.